Okay, thank you, David. I've chosen a title for this talk that is somewhat related to what I'm going to say. But right from the beginning, to avoid misconceptions, let me state that this question, whether or not spots influence the climate, is really an observational question. And it's an observational question that still has not been resolved. It's an observational question because our theories are not good enough to really calculate plausibly what the possible effects of sunspots or solar activity in general could be on the climate. And this is not so much a problem with the solar physics, in my opinion. We can measure the effects of sunspots on, say, the total luminosity of the sun. We can measure the solar wind and its effect on the magnetosphere. These things can be measured, and they are understood to a significant degree. But the difficulty comes, of course, when we do climate modeling, when small effects like spots, irradiance variations, or perhaps even things like cosmic rays influencing the ionosphere, when these things have to be modeled, that's so much more difficult that for the moment, as far as I can tell from the literature, this is better seen as an observational question. So I can't really answer this question directly, but I'll use it as an opportunity to tell you something about what one knows about the solar interior, how it is that luminosity variations of the sun, for example, behave as thermal disturbances in the sun. But let me then first show you, to remind you, what a sunspot looks like. Image from MDI on SOHO. And if you look at these spots in more detail, then you can see them move about. You see.
You said this was an image from something or other.
Right. Yeah, this is, sorry about this. This is an instrument in space, the SOHO satellite in the L1 point between the Earth and the Sun, looking at the Sun continuously, has various instruments on board. One of them is an imager, which also makes magnetic and velocity observations. This is just an image in the continuum, white light emission from the Sun. The image has been manipulated a little bit. Normally, a white light image of the Sun is noticeably darker at the limb. That gradient has been taken out. Apart from that, you see here a number of sunspots. This was last year when there was a period of high activity. Normally, there are far fewer sunspots, even at high activity levels. These sunspots have also been looked at with high-resolution imaging from the ground. Let me then. Okay.
What's the scale?
Well, let's see. This would be about 2,000 kilometers. Pardon? It's not a very large spot. It's maybe a few 10,000 kilometers in size. So this is the images that one can get from the ground. There's a certain amount of data processing involved because the Earth's atmosphere distorts the image. But with a large number of images and with image restoration techniques, one can get then these very high resolution. Actually, this is the effective resolution is significantly better than an arc second, maybe a third of an arc second or so.
This is also a continuum?
This is... I think this is probably not exactly continuum. It's what they call G-band. That's a molecular band. So it is a mixture of molecular lines and continuum. Let me just run it once more with my cursor. So there's all sorts of interesting velocities going on in it.
So this is real time?
This is, the clock is here on the left. So it's about a few hundred times real time. This is typically, say, a few hours of observing that you're seeing. So there's all sorts of interesting physics here that shows you how magnetic fields behave if they're embedded in fluid motions. The sun is one of the nice laboratories where we can actually see magnetohydrodynamics happening at very high magnetic Reynolds numbers. My cursor is gone here. So this is the dot movie. Let me then just say a few words about the history of this question, whether sunspots have an effect on the climate. Right since the sunspot cycle was discovered, the 11-year cycle, that the sunspots go up and down with 11-year cycle, it has become popular to correlate it with things happening on Earth. For example, the level of water in the lake in Lake Victoria for a couple of cycles has correlated with the solar cycle. And as you may remember, the stock market in the early 20th century was correlated with the sunspot cycle. And people have looked at many of such correlations. And as you may guess, most of those correlations have disappeared again by a process called regression to the mean. Because they were just selected out of noise, as it turns out. But more recently, there have been more plausible correlations. For example, there have been reports that the cycle of droughts in the Southwest, as recorded in Bristol cone pine tree rings, that correlates with the solar cycle. And for example, climate indicators like temperatures, various measures of temperatures from historical records. Here is one that shows springtime temperatures in China as deduced from historical records of the first date of peach blossoms in the imperial records of China. So one of these curves, because this the solid line is the sunspot activity, giving you a certain amount of cycles, and the dotted line is then this an interpretation of this historical record of peach blossoms.
Pardon? Is the number 11 understood correctly? Should I be surprised by 11? So such a small number, or should I not be surprised?
A relevant number is sort of the convective turnover time scale. A month.
So should I be surprised by 11?
Well, it depends how many orders of magnitude you. and typically. Typically, the sort of the theories that we have, if you call them theories, because there's very large assumptions made in them, they allow you. They would typically give you 1 year.
1 year.
So there's a factor of 10 missing. And then the story got a little bit more political when people started correlating the solar activity with the recent increase of temperature on Earth, the global warming effect. Here is an attempted correlation between the amplitude of the solar cycle and the North Atlantic sea surface temperature from historical records. And you see, well, maybe there's a correlation. People have then doctored the solar cycle a little bit to make the correlation go look more convincing. So from then on, there was this debate that's still going on, I think. Do we understand the sun well enough to exclude the possibility that global warming has something to do with sunspots? Which, of course, is a very political thing. Now, one can immediately say that if this is so, then we don't understand why it happens. because the known effects of sunspots are so small that most climate models would agree that they couldn't possibly have an effect. But as long as the climate is still somewhat uncertain, one doesn't know how sensitive the climate is to very small fluctuations, this is still, in at least in certain circles, considered an open question. But of course, we can look at the data and see if there's anything in the Earth climate that correlates with spot cycle. And there has recently appeared a very intriguing correlation. Which I would like to show now. This is from a paper in Science magazine. Oh, why doesn't it move now? We should just move it up a little bit, and a little bit to the right. Anyway, what you're seeing here is results from a seafloor core drilling experiment at various locations around Greenland. I should say this is Bond et al. In Science magazine, 7 December last year, where along the seas around Greenland, they have measured in cores in the sea surf, in the sea floor, the concentration of debris carried by glacier ice. So the icebergs drift down into the Atlantic, melt, and they drop a certain amount of the material that has been scraped off the surface of Greenland. And this material can be easily recognized because it has very characteristic minerals in it. And the
they drop stones. Actually, they carry stones, and then they melted, and stones fell down into the bottom of the sea.
Anyway, so they can actually also date these layers very accurately to about 20 years over the past 10,000 years or so. So there's a good record of how much drift ice there has been at various locations around Greenland as a function of time over the past 10,000 year, the Holocene era. And at the same time, one has also from ice core measurements in Greenland and in Antarctica, a very good record of concentration of various trace molecules in the Earth's atmosphere. You probably heard about these, but in anyway, they can measure from concentrations in of gases trapped in the ice over the past 10 to 100,000 years, measure a concentration of carbon dioxide, oxygen isotopes, carbon-14 and beryllium-10. Carbon-14 and beryllium-10 are radioactive. They're produced in the atmosphere by cosmic rays. And what's shown here now is that these tracers, carbon-14 on the left and beryllium-10 here on the right, that they seem to correlate with concentrations of this glacier-carried debris. So the solid lines are here various measurements that they make of concentrations of grit, their various minerals in the in this seafloor record, and this the blue line in this case is the beryllium-10 concentration. Same pattern for carbon-14.
If I can read the horizontal scale, it seems a cycle much longer than 11 years.
Oh yes, absolutely. So, yeah, this is thousands of years. So individual spot cycles are not seen here, but the sun, the solar cycle is modulated on larger timescales as well, up to thousands of years. For example, we know that in the 17th, 18th century was a dip in solar activity. So there's a time scales of at least hundreds of years, and those can be resolved by these measurements.
Is duration also off by a factor of 10 for that longer cycle?
the sun at the moment is about as active as it's as it typically can be.
But there's a theoretical prediction for
the
longest cycle.
No. Not really.
I see. But there's a theoretical prediction for the shortest cycle.
Somewhat, yeah. Well.
How does one get a historical record of these long time scales? I mean, people presumably weren't looking at the sun.
Yeah. Well, actually, this
to make observations.
The accurately dated record of solar activity comes from three rings, which can be dated down to a few thousand years ago.
But that's very indirect.
So what one can measure is just these things, these traces like carbon 14. And why are they related to solar activity at all? Well, the activity, the amount of radioactivity in carbon 14 and beryllium 10 is produced by cosmic rays. Now, the cosmic rays don't come from the sun, at least not the ones that do this, because the ones from the sun are shielded by the magnetosphere, but they come from the galaxy. And it's only because of the solar wind that there is a change in this cosmic ray flux. The solar wind sort of carries these things, fights against the cosmic rays coming in. There are magnetic irregularities in the solar wind. There's scattering on these magnetic irregularities. The solar wind is stronger, like at maximum activity. It pushes the cosmic rays further out, and there's a reduced production of carbon 14 at high solar activity. This is well known. You can measure it for each cycle. It is a very clear pattern. So this this record here is basically a very indirect but known correlation between radioactive traces and solar activity. And what can I say? The other part of it, the glaciers dropping the drift ice measurement, it is presumably somehow related to the climate, though I'm not sure people really see understand this connection very directly, because glaciers moving back and forth is not perhaps the easiest thing to model, and is probably very sensitive to small changes in temperature. At least these authors claim that you could, in principle, with only the observed variations in solar luminosity, you might actually influence the climate enough for this drift ice to fluctuate by this much. Perhaps it's also due to the fact that one measures these variations at a very critical location, namely roughly the location where the ice packs start to melt. So small fluctuations in the amount of or the temperature or the extent of the drift ice will have a large effect on the amount of sediment that's influenced. So this is then, I would say there's perhaps, and this looks good to me. I find it very hard to see how this could be an artifact of the way in which they measure this. So there appears to be some kind of an effect, which I would say at the moment is completely not understood. And why I'm saying that it's not understood, well, it's because the known effects that we know exist, like the darkness of sunspots, is so small. And let me then first show you then why we think that they're so small. Because we can measure it to some extent, and there's some theory about it.
How did they treat the variation of geomagnetic field?
That's right. Of course, there's also the Earth's magnetic field also changes on timescales on the order of 10,000 years, though these variations that you see here are typically shorter than that. So it's presumably a period of one polarity. The first effect is just the simple effect. If you see a spot on the surface, it looks dark. So the sun is a bit less bright. And as it rotates, you see this brightness variation. Let me show you that as a little movie here. Where's my movie here, Facula?
Where's the sun's rotation axis? Is that vertical?
Good question. This looks like it's somewhere here.
So the distribution depends on that, it's more on the solar equator?
Yeah, typically there are two bands, with the equator in between. So they're typically at roughly the same latitude, and that latitude drifts slowly towards the from the mid latitudes to the equator as the solar cycle progresses. Now, the sun rotates once per month, so you can see these little spots, these specks rotating, and you can see if that has an effect on the brightness of the sun. So if you were to fast forward your record of the sun, it would look like this. This was, a time of very high activity. This is not typical.
What are the numbers at the bottom? Is it
temperature? Or? They're probably counts of some sort. I'm not sure what they are. Now, you notice here that as the sunspots rotate towards the limb, they're foreshortened. But then at the same time, there's also something else. Namely, these brighter patches.
The yellow stuff.
Yeah, the white stuff here. Let me, here for example.
Mm-hmm. This is a temperature important because the brightest features, ocular, they're very bright, right. And the average temperature is 6,000 degrees in the sun.
Well, thank you.
Good. So,
I don't think that's not that scale because that would say the sun is at 10,000 degrees.
No, it's not.
No, but this is just scale. But what you see on the sun is not exactly all these numbers.
So I showed it once more to draw your attention to the fact that these faculae, these brighter areas, have a funny property, that they appear mostly at the limb. As they move towards the center, they become less visible, and then when you go towards the other limb, they become brighter again. So they have a peculiar property that they radiate more horizontally than the normal surface.
Is that directly understood or so?
I think so. But some people don't think it.
This is the Institute of Theoretical Physics. They always ask this question.
Now, if you want to measure this from the ground, you see these dark things moving around and you see the bright area, so you could just say, well, let's add up these patches and see how much the sun varies. The difficulty there is that because of transparency fluctuations in the atmosphere, you can't reach that accuracy. What can be done from space is much more accurate, but so far only for the total brightness of the sun, where one has very accurate measurements. So there's still a little gap in the connection with sunspots. From space, one can measure accurately the total brightness of the sun, and you can see correlations with these sunspots rotating about. But you cannot verify that correlation on a point-by-point basis on the surface. But that having said that, we can show you the space-based record, which is basically, where is it now? Seem to have lost this one, but let me then take this one here. So what you see here is in the solid line, just focus on this part, on the solid line, variation of the total integrated solar brightness in watts per square meter. at Earth, normalized to nominal distance between Earth and the Sun. And you can see that there is now an 11-year cycle in it. These are just the years. In the sense that during solar maximum, the Sun is also slightly brighter, which is somewhat opposite to what you would have expected if it's only the sunspots. Sunspots, if they rotate, would just give you dips. Now, these dips have also been seen in this same record, but of course, you have to go to shorter timescales to see them. This is a case where a large sunspot group was passing over the surface, and you very clearly see that in the middle, and it's at the more or less at the center of the disk, the brightness actually went down a bit. And this can be correlated in various cases with known passage of structures on the surface of the Sun.
Looks like it's about the same size of effect, too.
Yeah, that's right. It's about the same effect. It can, in fact, be larger. So you see an overall increase, and on top of that, sharp dips due to sunspots. Yeah, 1/10%. Yeah.
What's the difference between dotted line and solid line? See me in experiment?
Well, let's see. Dashed line. Well, okay. This is the observed irradiance, as they call it. And the dotted line is what you reconstruct by saying, well, let's assume the spots are dark. We can measure their areas from the ground and just add up and see if that matches.
Oh, so that works very well, that simple theory.
Yes.
Including the details.
Yeah. Now, this is perhaps a somewhat special case. There are also cases where there are very few spots and mostly this bright stuff. And there, then, the situation is more difficult because it's much more diffuse. It's very hard to measure that accurately from the ground. Sunspots are very clearly defined. You can measure how dark they are, can just add up things. That gives you roughly this kind of accuracy. But if it's mostly dominated by the brighter stuff, then it's more difficult. And we've seen from this overall trend over a cycle that the bright stuff seems to dominate. So that's where the difficulty in interpretation still hangs at the moment.
I think for this part of the 1,000 on the bottom plot, yeah, you're showing, that's the total radiance measured over what the total band pass. No, sorry, on the one in the PowerPoint. So the part of the 1,000 level, integrating over, I mean, what, this is not just white light, this is obviously a much broader integration.
Yeah, this is a bolometric thing. So it just measures heat, the total heat that comes into a little opening. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
It's actually a very clever experiment.
Yeah. So it really is radiation. So it's
and the
ultimate absorber sitting there and getting it.
Yeah. And they claim a very high accuracy, like also on the order of 1/10%.
So you mentioned that the images you showed us were corrected for thin darkening. And you also hinted that the facular behavior was due to anisotropic radiance, but I'd always thought it was a contrast effect that on the meridian you're just seeing these bright areas, but the absorbance, they're not starting to say absorbance is the rest, that's why they show up with a limb.
Well, that's a way of looking at it. If you just look at the brightness of these faculae, then they're not at the limb very much brighter than at the disk center. It's more that the background is darker at the limb. So, now, okay, maybe this is a good point to say this. The reason why the Sun is limb darkened is that the temperature decreases upward in the atmosphere. So if I look at an angle into the Sun, because for a given opacity, I won't be looking quite as deeply into the Sun, so I see a source function somewhat higher up in the atmosphere where the temperatures are lower. And therefore, in terms of if that layer were a black body emitter, you would see a lower temperature there, lower brightness.
So the fact that you're actually higher up, the lofty features in the atmosphere?
Well, at the moment, if we just say that they are, if they had the same temperature gradient with depth, then you wouldn't see them in this way. So apparently, it looks as if the temperature gradient is flatter, but you can't actually say whether that is geometrically up or down because you only can measure optical depth. Okay, but But at the end, I hope I come back to this issue about secular brightness a bit. I have to hurry up tremendously. So we see that there's various kinds of measurements one can make, and the effect is 0.1%. And that, in most climate models, is just not enough. So let's leave it at that point. I'd like to come back again to this observed effect that spots seem to act as if they just cover a certain part of the surface, and that's all there is to it. And the problem arises when you start thinking about this. Because you could think, well, look here, the interior of the sun doesn't know anything about sunspots. It produces a certain luminosity. Surely that luminosity has to get out somehow. It's on the order of 60 megawatts per square meter at the surface. How can you possibly stop such a heat flux? But it turns out that yes, you can. And that's what I would like to show you now. I think I've done with this thing here. Maybe I have some light here. And the way I would like to do this is by first giving you an analogy. First giving you an analogy and then show why the sun, why this is a good analogy for the sun. So first the analogy. And the analogy is a spacecraft. And I'll model it as a very simple object, a cubic meter of aluminum. And inside it, there's various electronics that produces heat. And it radiates this heat away from the surface into vacuum. And the engineers have designed it in such a way that the surface temperature is on the order of 300 degrees. Now, I can ask myself the question, this thing, let it go into equilibrium, so this the whole thing has the same temperature, and it's radiating from the surface, and it's steady. And now I put on the surface a piece of insulating material that blocks this radiation, infrared radiation, from the surface. What happens to this heat flux? Where does it go? Well, in order to answer that question, let's first look at some timescales. And we can define, for example, a diffusion timescale. The heat in this piece of aluminum diffuses about with a certain known diffusivity, so that the heat flux in watts per square meter is k times the gradient of t. And for aluminum, the numbers are that k is 300 watts per meter per Kelvin. The density is 270 kilograms per cubic meter. And the heat capacity, specific heat capacity, is 10 to the 3 joules per kilogram per Kelvin. So if I now look at the time-dependent diffusion process in this piece of aluminum, then there's an equation for this that says that rho Cp times ddt of t is divergence of the heat flux. So taking kappa as constant, this says that rho Cp
dt. Isn't rho too small?
Should be another zero.
Yes, sorry. Yeah. So that or dt, sorry, k dt of t is a number kappa times del squared of t, where kappa is k over rho cp, and that turns out to be on the order of kappa for aluminum with this number of the order 10 to the minus 3 square meter per second, 10 to the minus 4 square meter per second. So from this, I can then calculate a diffusion time scale around aluminum of this chunk of that size by saying that, well, for heat to balance between different parts of this chunk, I need a time scale that's just given by dimensional analysis of this equation, namely T diffusion is L squared over kappa. And for this 1 meter, that's done on the order of 10 to the 4 seconds. At the same time, I can also calculate the heat content in this volume. And at these values, this comes about on the order of, at these numbers, comes out to be about 10 to the 9 joules. For a temperature of 300 degrees, this value of the heat capacity, density, and a length of the order of 1 meter. Now, this is the heat content. There's also a power input into this object. So I can define a thermal time scale. There's now a second time scale involved. Is the heat content divided by the power input W.
This is a solid aluminum ball, right?
Yeah.
We know it was a shell ball. It's a ball.
Well, I've sort of made it just a volume object. Huh? It's a rather primitive model. But, and we can compute the heat input that we need from just this balance, so and so much goes in and so much is radiated at the surface from 300 degrees. And this turns out to be, for the emissivity of aluminum, like 30% of maximum. OK, let me first show you what you need to balance then, of course. So the heat balance is given by sigma T to the fourth, Stefan Boltzmann's law, times the area is the heat input. And I've added a little fudge factor here, epsilon, because aluminum is not perfectly emitting, especially if it's not polished. If you do this balance for this kind of temperatures, you'll find that you need a kilowatt. So then our time scale, thermal time scale, will turn out to be 10 to the 9 divided 10 to the 3, about 10 to the 6 seconds. It is for this amount of mass in such a volume, it's a rather large time scale. But the main important thing is not these absolute numbers, but the ratio of this long thermal time scale to the short one, mm-hmm. which is only 10 to the 4 seconds. Mm-hmm. And they're very different physical objects. And you have to take both of them into account. Mm-hmm. So if I now, what happens if I put this insulating blanket on the surface? What happens to the total emission radiated from the surface as a function of time? If this were the steady value, it's just as this. And this time scale is the long time scale, because in order for it to come into equilibrium, it has to reach a higher temperature so that the area that you blocked is compensated by higher emission from the rest. So you need to heat up the whole thing. And that's why, at the instant when I block this surface, nothing happens to the surface area around it, because it takes that thermal time scale. And if I then decide that after a certain time I switch off that thermal blanket again, it will do something like this instead. So if the time scale on which I put blankets on and remove them is short compared to this thermal time scale, then the only thing I see is dips. And this is what happens in the case of sunspots also.
Well, are you saying that the diffusive time scale doesn't show up in this thought experiment at all?
Well, yeah. it starts showing up if you think a bit deeper about the small perturbations that are still there.
Yes.
Due to the fact that these timescales are not very far apart. If you're only a factor of 100 apart, then you can ask yourself the question, well, but this heat flux that's blocked here in the steady state, for example, at the end when it's in equilibrium again, mm-hmm. where does that blocked heat go? Well, you know, it will sort of show up somewhere near the surroundings. Mm-hmm. If this is maybe 30 centimeters, then it will show up here at that typical distance. And then you can make a little calculation. If I balance, if I have to make a temperature, a heat flux divert over such a distance, what kind of temperature difference do I need for that? And with this kind of conductivity, you'll find that that's on the order of a fraction of a degree. So there is, yes, there is an effect in the immediate surroundings. And it is asserted, it can be measured. But its effect on the emission from the surface is very small, because even a degree or a fraction of a degree is only a fraction of the surface temperature. And since the emission from the surface goes just as 4 times delta T over T, the total emission from the rest of the surface is hardly affected. Even though I have a very large perturbation in the heat flux here, the changes in the surface irradiance are very small. Surface luminosity are very small. Is that clear? Good. Anyway, so this is the, if you're still willing to accept the analogy, it's the reason why if I put a sun, if I see a sunspot appearing, there doesn't seem to be a bright ring around it. This is a known problem. People have noticed this from the beginning, and it's called the bright ring problem. Why? And so my answer to this question is that this analogy holds. But now the question is, why would this analogy hold? And it has to do with convection. The outer part of the sun, the outer 29%, 200,000 kilometers, 29% of our sun, is convective. And the consequence of that is that there's a very direct thermal connection between different parts of that convective envelope. A little bit of heat that's too much here diffuses around very quickly by these convective flows. It's a bit like in the Earth's troposphere. If on a normal day in the summer you release a plume, it can in principle go up all the way to the stratosphere. This would be very different if you're stably stratified, because then the plumes just, you know, saturate at a very low altitude. And the same thing happens here. So if I produce a small increase in temperature here, it will immediately communicate around. So with that, a time scale of a year or so. So this, if you take just average numbers for the convective properties, you'll find that convective velocities are of the order of 10 to the 4. Sorry, let me just not mention the velocities, but say, if I measure the effect of this convection by, again, a turbulent diffusivity in square meters per second, then I'll find that this is on the order, through the convection zone, on the order of 10 to the 9 square meters per second. And into the depth of the convection zone, this gives me a thermal times, a diffusion time scale of the order of 1 year. So this is still pretty long, even compared to the scale, the speed at which sunspots appear and disappear. But as I showed in this analogy, I have to compare it with another time scale, namely the thermal time scale of this thing as a whole, because this convection connects everything. So a small heat perturbation has to heat up the entire convection zone. And that time scale is the thermal heat content of the envelope divided by the sun's luminosity. And that turns out to be 10 to the 5 years. And it's basically because the sun is so large. There's an enormous amount of mass in there. 2% of the solar mass is in this envelope. This time scale is related to the so-called Kelvin contraction time of the sun. This is the time scale on which the sun would cool off if you switch off the heat generation in the center. That's about 100 times larger, because the mass of the sun is about 100 times as large as it is in this envelope. So the thermal time scale of the sun as a whole is 10 million years. Thermal time scale of the envelope is 100,000 years. So here we have the same situation as in the aluminum analogy, except that the ratio of time scales is very much more extreme. So that justifies the analogy to some extent, but there is a little complication that I have swept under the rug here. I've used typical values. Now this number, as it turns out, is fairly independent of depth in the sun, but the density in the sun is not. The density at the surface is a million times lower than it is here, the very strong stratification. So if I were to look at it in terms of this thermal diffusivity K, which is rho times Cp times this kappa here, then this object is very highly stratified. Thermal diffusivity at the surface is a million times less than it is at the base. So there is, then that causes slight effects. And the one way of looking at it is by writing again the same diffusion equation, but taking now into account that this diffusivity, the diffusion properties of this convection zone is a function of depth. And then you'll find, perhaps not to your surprise, that now it depends a little bit on where exactly I put this blanket. If I just put it directly at the surface, then there's a very noticeable bright ring to compensate for this process, and that has to do with the fact that in the surface, the sun is not really a very good thermal conductor. But if I put it a slightly deeper into the sun, then it reaches to layers where the diffusion coefficient is very high already. And you can make this quantitative with the known stratification of the envelope. And it turns out that it's sufficient to push this blocking layer down by about 1,000 kilometers below the surface. That's about, in terms of horizontal size, is 1,000th of the size of the sun, on the order of 1 arc second in horizontal measurements. Now, so then the question arises, do you believe that the blocking effect of sunspots extends, is really very superficial, or whether it extends all the way in, or to what extent, to what depth it actually extends? And there you have to, of course, make a little bit of theory. You have to believe certain things about sunspots. So that raises the question, why are sunspots dark to begin with?
Can I just go on, please? Yeah. How do you justify this approximation of the sunspot as a lid? It's not solid lid you put.
That's exactly what I.
Something. It's a natural phenomenon which you raise.
Well, that's what I just was.
Oh,
I'm
that's
coming.
What you want to understand.
Okay. Now we can. To some extent, it's an observational question. We know that heat is carried to the surface by convection. The reason for that is that at these temperatures, hydrogen is partially ionized, and it's very opaque, very many transitions being activated in very large opacity. So thermal flux by photons is very small compared to this fluid flow carrying convective heat flux. So as soon as I start interfering with convection, there will be temperature gradient set up. Now we know that since the field lines are continuous, there are no monopoles on the sun, so that this surface effect that we see, vertical magnetic fields in sunspots, must extend down. And we know its strength on the order of a third of a Tesla. 3,000 Gauss sounds better somehow. And this turns out to be is enough to have an effect on convection. So the same order as the kinetic energy density in convection there. And this is in fact what you see. Convection is suppressed. And inside sunspots, there's very much less convective motions. It's not completely suppressed, especially in these horizontal parts here. There's still lots of activity going on. But the dark parts in the center are much more quiet, much less convective velocities. So that means now that we have here a layer where radiation still cools the surface, but where the supply of heat by convection is reduced. And it finds a new equilibrium, of course, but that equilibrium will be at a lower temperature. So that's the belief why sunspots are dark. And the analogy with the aluminum tells you that it's a local effect because these magnetic field lines really extend all the way down, or at least to a significant depth. So that fits together quite nicely. But there's still a little bit of a problem because we have now explained how sunspots can produce darkenings, these little dips. But we've seen that the overall effect during the cycle is the opposite, that during maximum, the brightening dominates. And the question arises how that can be. And there, I must say that there is a bit of a controversy at the moment in the literature about this. And it has to do with the fact that this brighter material that I showed, that shows up at the limb, is really, much of it is really quite diffuse. It's only in young active regions, as we call them, that you see them so nicely compact. But from high resolution observations, you can look at small magnetic elements, you can see that this brightening is basically everywhere, wherever there's a small scale magnetic field on the sun. So then two questions arise. Does this effect that small magnetic elements are also bright, does that account for the brightening that you see at maximum? One question. And the second question is, do we understand why these little magnetic elements are bright in the first place? Why they do the opposite of what sunspots do? Now, the first question, whether this actually explains the brightening that we see, is hard to answer at the moment. Because to be really sure, you would have to measure each pixel on the surface. These elements turn out to be very, very tiny, less than an arc second. And you have to very accurately add them up to be sure that it explains the average signal that you see. And this, at the moment, just cannot be done. So what one does in practice are these proxy indicators. You know that the brightening that you see in these little factor elements correlates with other things. For example, it correlates very nicely with microwave emission from the surface of the sun. And it correlates very nicely with brightenings you see in spectral lines. And those we can measure accurately, because the effects there are much larger than these tiny little brightness variations on the surface. So if you're willing to believe that those are good proxies for the actual surface brightness, then it turns out that you can explain at least 90% of the solar cycle variation, including the brightening at solar maximum, by just these, the cumulative effect of all these dark and bright areas. But since this makes use of a proxy, there are people who don't like this, consider it too indirect, and this gives rise to a whole discussion about how to measure this more accurately. In particular, to make sure that there are no real surprises, that the sun doesn't do something that we haven't thought of theoretically. The theoretical picture I gave here is by some people considered not solid enough, and there's more need for more data, is then the argument. So that's then the status for the observational question. Then the theoretical question is what I would like to close with, is why it is that sunspots are dark and this more patchy stuff is bright. Now, if you look at the very high resolution image of these little brightenings, you'll see it's completely fragmented. They're very small little magnetic elements. So they look the same as sunspots, but on a very much smaller scale. Now, inside these little elements, just like in sunspot, the densities are lower. So if you actually look at the optical depth unity surface in a sunspot, then it actually looks a bit like. And this can be measured. It's called Wilson depression. And you can see it by looking at a sunspot near the limb. You can see that shift. And it's about 700, 600 kilometers. The same effect must happen here, because the density in such small elements is also lower due to magnetic pressure. This is basically the lower density due to magnetic pressure that does this. So the thing, but on that smaller scale, the effect is much more drastic. It's the same amount of depression, but the element is much, much smaller. And now we have to worry about not only this surface, which is dark, but we have to worry also about.
Why is it the same depth? Because these magnetic elements have not 3,000 Gauss.
That's true. They have 1,000 Gauss. And so actually, it's a bit less. It's about the scale height, about 100 kilometers. But it's the same order. So here it may be 100. And that is of the same order as the size, the horizontal size of these elements. Many of them, in fact, may be a lot smaller than this. Now the question is, this is now a two-dimensional problem. Huh? There's not only heat coming from here, but also from the surfaces here. Now, in order to do this properly, you would have to make a thermal model that it tells you exactly how the heat flux flows through such a structure. And that has been done to some extent. And it turns out that the result is really fairly simple. It's almost as if this surface here behaves in the same way as this surface, except that it's vertical. You have the same heat fluxes around, the same opacities, it's just that the surface is oriented a little bit. This is the lowest order picture. It's not completely accurate. But this explains then why it is that we see this material bright near the limb, because we're looking face on, whereas here we're looking higher up in the atmosphere where it's cooler. So this is what I call a bright wall effect. And to be sure, you have to do a much more complicated calculation, a complete magneto hydrodynamic calculation, where the convective flows surrounding this element are taken into account. And significant progress has been made in that direction, and sort of seems to confirm part of this picture at least. So we have, I think, both a theoretical candidate for this brightening and proxy measurements. You could also look at it this way, that you say, well, it's a bit like surface roughness. If I take a polished metal, it radiates preferentially in this direction. If I rough it up, then it becomes more of a Lambert surface that radiates in all directions. And the sun is not a perfectly polished emitter, so to speak. And by making these little dents in it, it likes roughening the surface and thereby increasing the emissivity.
How can it be total balance? When you blow, you hide some heat inside, but when we see excessive heat, how do we explain that sun produces certain amount of radiation and you can't exceed it?
Well, that's what
it looks like a trick you can exceed.
Well, that's what I try to explain in this analogy that the, and you may or may not like it, but.
No.
For this thing, the situation is quite similar. It's just a sign change compared to the blocking effect. And there's a little complication here because this thing is now not very large anymore. So it doesn't extend as deep as the sunspot. And if you do this diffusion calculation, sure enough, there's a little dark ring surrounding it. The opposite of the bright ring that you would expect for a sunspot. But depending on the size of that tube, the net brightening can actually dominate.
Even your horizontal region there should be brighter though too, because it's not radiating, it's radiating to a smaller solid angle.
Yeah, right. Now that's the dominant effect that can more than compensate for the little dark ring around it.
I presume that an important factor must also be that the convective cell size is large compared to that tube and small compared to the...
Yeah, yeah. So then, basically the problem is that whereas this sort of diffusion model for convection is still a fair approximation of sunspots because the elements, the convective elements you see at the surface are very small compared to a spot. There's not a good approximation here anymore. So you can do it by this diffusion approximation. Instead, you would have to use a real flow model. Now, it is known what the flow around such an element does, because these things are embedded in downflows. You can just see that on the surface, they're between granules and downflows. So there's a systematic flow like this. So actually, you don't even have to worry about this dark ring, because this is not just a random diffusion process. The heat is being advected systematically towards this layer, towards this wall. So let me then just wrap up by saying that given that we still have uncertainties in how exactly convection behaves in the sun, I would still submit that this is a good lowest order picture, and that the effects are so dramatic, they really rely on this very large difference in timescales, and that's a very generic feature of the sun that makes it the analogy with the aluminum block valid, in my opinion, even if we don't completely understand the details of convection in the sun. So I think we're then basically back to the simplest picture that you would have if you didn't think very much at all. There are dark and bright features on the surface of the sun, and that's all there is to it, the surface effect. Our people who don't like this picture call it superficial effect. But I think it's still a good model.
But you haven't said anything about why there should be a cycle.
No. No, should I? Well, that's even more controversial. There are models that I would say are a good, give you sort of a good scenario, or what's the right word for it? A sort of a theme kind of thing that describes this. It's a mean field model. And it has a difficulty that whenever you look at the sun in detail, it's very hard to believe that you can describe it with these mean fields. The sun, the magnetic fields in the sun are much more systematic. So there is a push, there has always been a certain push towards making models that are really take into account the observed properties when an active region emerges, for example. The Hale's polarity law, that there's always a very well-defined orientation of polarities in active regions. And this has been done, you know, continuously since the beginning of understanding of the solar cycle, or observations of the solar cycle. And in my opinion, it was one of the nicest models in the late 90s by Bob Layton of Caltech. Basically give the ingredients which I think are important for it. But it has not been developed very far because of fundamental difficulties. You really need a lot more neutrodynamic computational power to really make such a model more quantitative. So there are practical limitations, but I think at the moment we're getting to the point where magnetohydrodynamic simulations will be able to do something more significant, and then perhaps we'll have a good model for why it's 11 years.
Very well, thank you.
Did I understand correctly that none of this has anything to do with the climate?
I would say it would be very nice if it didn't. But the observations show that there still seems to be some kind of correlation, which is unexplained. People speculate. One speculation is that it happens to be such that we live at a very special point in the Earth's climate parameter space.
The anthropic principle.
Exactly, yeah. Like an anthropic principle that says that that the climate is such that it is extremely sensitive to small variations on the sun. Now that cannot be the case over, you know, there must be something either coincidental or special about the situation. So I don't really like that.
Do you blame the climate models, in other words?
Well, it is hard.
I think that's
No, but there is a two things. He mentioned this 0.1% change right. in total radiance,
and that does nothing
which is very small, and maybe some philosophical principle is needed. But then if you look at the last of his talk, when he considered this bright vacuum, they mean UV radiation. And these guys are changing 100 times more than 0.1%. And those are real effects which atmospheric science takes into account. We don't know my exact answer to your question, but it's not a small effect, it's a big effect.
Yeah, it's a big effect in the upper stratosphere.
In the stratosphere.
And then the question is again, how can the low density in the upper stratosphere, etc. So then it becomes again, how can this have such a global effect? This is one thing. The other issue one has to remember, I think, is that this what I would consider the best evidence, this glacier debris record, may be an indicator that's unusually sensitive because it has been put exactly the right place. It's been measured exactly the right place where the glaciers, where the icebergs drop their load into the ocean, and that small, even really small changes in the climate that have no effect in terms of global warming could produce this.
So I read
question, if this analogy is right, you know, it looks like the small magnetic element just barely beat out the sunspots in terms of the sun's irradiance. What would you expect on these really active M dwarfs where you have 20% of the star, 30% of the star, 50% of the star, a couple of spots?
Yeah. Well, this has been studied to some extent because you can look at this balance for different solar cycles. And there is the claim that you can actually see that as the activity level is higher, that then sunspots start to dominate more over the brightening. So that this is then somewhat of a coincidence that on the sun, at the average level of activity that it has now, the two will roughly balance, though there's a clear excess of the brightenings. And the prediction is then that if the solar cycle becomes stronger than this, then the effect will go down. That sunspots will start producing more of an effect than the brightenings. And this is to some extent also seen in stars, which are more active than the sun, that there the spots seem to dominate over the brightenings.
Are there other types of things which occur in other stars because of the different scaling of the two thermal times you gave us with radiance particularly? So, I mean, although they're quite far apart from the sun, they're not 9 orbs apart. I mean, are there large stars where their order is inverted and you have different physics?
Oh, yes. Because there are stars, somewhat more massive stars than the sun, 2 or 3 solar masses, they don't have this convective envelope or very little of it. And so there the argument that you have this very sort of thermal superconductor in the surface layer doesn't apply. But those are also stars in which there are no sunspots in the usual sense because they are also connected with this convective envelope. There are stars, however, the magnetic A stars, which have a magnetic field presumably for a different reason. And there are various interesting effects, but certainly those are not dark. They're just approximately the same temperature as the rest of the surface.
You've got a very beautifully simple geometrical model of the variation of brightness of whatever they call the bright spots, because the sun goes around. But there must be a lot of detailed data on the light curve, so to speak, of these. Does it fit? Does the geometrical model fit?
Well, yes, that's what my good friend Peter Focal would claim. Put that down also. As I say, the difficulty is that in order to be really sure, you would have to resolve each of these little elements and measure their absolute brightness. That cannot be done. But these brightenings correlate with things like emission in calcium line or emission in microwave emission. And if you believe that you can calibrate those correlations, then you can use them to measure effectively how many of these brightenings one has, even in the very distributed parts on the surface. And if you take that into account, then you get a very much nicer correlation. Actually, this was it already.
Because it's still warming up.
It's still warming up, you think? Okay, good. This is then the comparison.
I remember.
Yeah. Okay.
You try to explain everything by geometrical blocking of the sun by dark spots or bright spots.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a school of thought which believes there's something going on inside the sun, and which is not geometrical, which is sort of physical. What can you have in common on this point?
Yeah, well, it's extremely hard to exclude that there could be something else, because you would have to go through all possibilities. But let me just give you an argument why it's...
Within the laws of physics.
Yeah, within the laws. Well, suppose there were little black holes zipping around in the sun. There are certain things that are hard to exclude, but a sort of a generic argument that is not really a proof is a look at the base of the convection zone conditions there. You have a density of the order of a tenth of the density of water with a temperature of 1,000,000 degrees, has a huge heat content. Even if you change the heat flux there by order unity, So that in order to have of having the heat flux going up, making it go horizontal, what kind of effect would that have, would you need to produce this? Turns out it's only a couple of degrees out of these million. This has to do with the fact that it has this very large density, which is also the reason why this thermal time scale is so long. So if you are going to change the luminosity of the sun by things happening down there, you need enormous amounts of energy for doing it. And it's far more efficient to just cover the surface a little bit.
Okay, that's my question.